Part 2. My son, my Kavika, what are you doing today? I know where you are, because Mama told me. New York. But where in New York, I wonder? And what are you doing there? She said you were working in a law firm, though not a lawyer, but you mustn't think I'm any less proud of you for that. I visited New York once. Did you know that? Yes, it's true. Your papa has some secrets of his own. I think about you often. When I'm awake, but also when I'm asleep. All of my dreams are about you in one way or another. Sometimes I dream about the time before we went to Lipovau Naheli, when we were together in your grandmother's house, and we used to take our midnight walks. Do you remember those? I would wake you up, and we'd sneak outside, up Oahu Avenue, to East Manoa Road we'd go, and then up Mohalo Way, because one of the houses there had a trumpet bush in its front yard that fascinated you. Do you remember this? It had pale yellow flowers, the color of ivory, that grew upside down and looked like the bell of a cornet. At least, that's what people said. You didn't agree, however. The upside-down tulip tree, you used to call it. And I could never see it any other way after that. Then down Lipioma Way we'd go, and over to Beckwith, and then down Manoa Road, and then home. It's funny, of all the things I was scared of, I was never scared of the dark. In the dark, everyone was helpless. And knowing that I was just like everyone else, no less, made me feel braver. I love those walks of ours. I think you did too. We had to stop them after you told your teacher about them. You were falling asleep in class, and your teacher asked why. And you told her it was because of our nighttime walks. And your teacher called me in to see her, and I got in trouble. He's growing, Mr. Bingham, she said. He needs his sleep. You can't be waking him up in the middle of the night to go on walks. I felt foolish, but she was kind to me. She could have told your grandmother, but she didn't. I just want to spend more time with him, I told the teacher. And she looked at me in the way that people often did. That made me realize I'd said something wrong, something queer. But finally she had nodded. You love your son, Mr. Bingham, she said. And that's a wonderful thing. But if you really love him, you'll let him sleep. I was embarrassed then, because of course she was right. You were just a child. I had no right to wake you and take you from your bed. The first time I did so, you were confused. But then you grew to expect it, and you would rub your eyes and yawn. But you never complained. You would put on your slippers and take my hand and follow me down the path. I never had to tell you not to tell your grandmother. You already knew not to. Later, I told Edward that I had gotten in trouble with the teacher and why. You dumbass, he said. But in a way so that I knew he wasn't mad, just frustrated. They could have called child services and taken Kavika away for that. Could they have? I asked. It was the worst thing I could imagine. Course they could have, he said. But don't worry. When we go to Lipovau Naheli, you can raise Kavika however you want, and no one can say anything about it. What else do you remember? All I can do is remember. I can see, a little, but just light and darkness. Do you remember how we used to go to the Chinese cemetery and sit near the monkey pod tree at the top of the hill? We'd lie right on the grass, with our faces turned up to the sun. Keep your eyes shut, I'd tell you. But even though we did, we could still see a field of orange, little blobs of black flickering across it like flies. After I told you how vision worked, you asked me if you were seeing the back of your eye. And I told you that maybe you were. Anyway, it's like that. I can see color and those blobs, but not much else. When they take me outdoors, though, they put sunglasses on me first. This is because, according to one of the doctors here, I should still be able to see. There's nothing wrong with my eyes as such, and so they need to be protected. Until recently, your grandmother used to bring pictures of you, which she'd hold in front of me, so close that the paper tickled against my nose. "Look at him, Vika," she'd say. "Look at him. Stop this nonsense. Don't you want to see pictures of your son?" Of course I did. And I tried. I tried hard. But I could never see more than the outline of the square of paper, maybe the dark of your hair. Or maybe it wasn't a picture of you at all that she was showing me. Maybe it was a picture of a cat or a mushroom. I couldn't tell the difference. The point is that I never see everything new. Everything I see, I've seen before. But although I can't see, I can hear. Most of it doesn't make much sense to me, not because I can't understand it exactly, but because I'm so often asleep that it's difficult for me to keep track of what I'm actually hearing and what I'm imagining. And sometimes, when I'm trying to figure it out, I fall asleep again. And then, when I wake next, I'm more confused. Assuming I can recall what I was trying to sort out before I fell asleep, I, by then, don't know whether I really heard what I thought I heard or whether I had been hallucinating. Your being in New York, for example. I woke with the strong feeling you were there. But were you really? Had someone told me that, or had I invented it? I thought and thought, so hard that I could hear myself begin to whimper with frustration and confusion, and then someone came into my room, and then there was blankness. When I woke again, I remembered only that I had been upset, and it wasn't until later that I remembered why. I had no way to ask whether you were in New York or not, of course, and so I just had to wait until someone, your grandmother, came to visit me again and hope that she would mention you. And eventually she did come and said that she'd gotten a letter from you and that the weather in New York was hot, hot and rainy, and that you wanted me to get better. Now I suppose you're wondering how I knew that this was actually happening, that I wasn't dreaming it. And the answer is because that day I could smell the flowers your grandmother was wearing. Do you remember how, when the pakalana vine was in bloom, she'd send you to the side of the house to pick a few clusters, and then she'd put them in that little silver brooch she had, the one shaped like a vase that could actually hold a few blossoms? That was how I knew it was real. And also that it was summer, because pakalana only blooms in summer. It's also why, whenever I think of you and New York, I smell pakalana. I don't know how long you've been away. I think it must be a very long time. Years, maybe even a decade. But then I realize that if that's so, it means that I've been here, in this place, for years, maybe even a decade. And then I can hear myself beginning to moan, louder and louder, and thrash my arms and legs, and piss myself. And then I can hear the sound of people running toward me. And sometimes I hear them say my name. "Vika, Vika, you need to calm down. You need to calm down, Vika." Vika. They only call me Vika. No one here calls me Mr. Bingham, unless your grandmother is visiting. But that's fine. It never felt right, being called Mr. Bingham. But I can't calm down, because now I'm thinking about how I'll never get out of here, about how my life, my entire life, has been spent in places I can't escape. Your grandmother's house, Lipo Valnahali, and now here, this island, I could never really leave. But you did. You got away. And so I keep making the sounds I can, slapping away their hands, wailing over their attempts to soothe me. And I keep doing it until I feel the medication entering my veins, warming my body, calming my heart, delivering me back to a state of forgetting. I want to talk to you, my son, my Kavika. Though I know you will never hear me, as I will never be able to say any of this aloud to you, not anymore. But I want to talk to you about everything that happened and try to explain to you why I did what I did. You have never visited me. I know this, and yet I also don't. Sometimes I'm able to pretend that you have visited me, that I'm just confused. But I know you haven't. I don't know what your voice sounds like anymore. I don't know what you smell like. The image I have of you is from when you were 15 and leaving me after one of our weekends together. And I didn't know. Maybe you didn't either. Maybe you still loved me a little then, despite everything, that I would never see you again. Of course, this makes me sad, not just for my sake, but for yours as well. Because you have a father who is both alive and yet not. And yet you are still a young man, and a young man needs his father. I can't tell you exactly where I am, because I don't know. Sometimes I imagine I must be on Tantalus, high up in the forest, because it's cool and rainy and very quiet. But it could also be in Nu'uanu, or even in Manoa. I do know I'm not at our house, because this place doesn't smell like our house. For a long time, I thought I was in a hospital, but it doesn't smell like a hospital either. But there are doctors and nurses and orderlies, and they all take care of me. For a long time, I didn't leave my bed at all, and then they started making me. "Come on, Vika," a man's voice would say. "Come on, brada." And I could feel a hand on my back, helping me sit, and then four hands on me, two wrapped around my waist, lifting me up and setting me down again. Then I was being pushed, and I could feel that we had left the building. I could feel the sun on my neck. One of the hands tipped my chin up. I closed my eyes. "That feels good, doesn't it, Vika?" said the voice. But then he let go of my chin, and my head flopped forward again. Now when they take me around the building, or out to the garden, they strap something around my forehead so that my head stays in place. Sometimes a woman comes and moves my arms and legs and talks to me. She bends and straightens each limb, and then she rubs me before turning me onto my stomach and kneading my back. There would have been a time when that would have made me embarrassed, to be lying there without any clothes on and with a strange woman touching me. But now I don't mind. Her name is Rosemary, and as she massages me, she talks about her day and her family, her husband, who's an accountant, her son and daughter, who are still in elementary school. Occasionally, she'll say something that makes me realize how much time has passed. But then later, I get confused because, once again, I don't know if she actually said it or if I just made it up. Did the Berlin Wall fall or did it not? Are there now colonies on Mars or are there not? Did Edward triumph after all? And has the monarchy been restored? Am I named king of the Hawaiian Islands? And my mother the queen regent? Or has it not? One time she said something about you, about my son, and I became agitated, and she had to buzz for help. And since then, she's never mentioned you again. Today, I thought of you as they were feeding me my dinner. Everything I eat is soft, because sometimes I think too much about swallowing, and then I start panicking and gagging. But if I don't have to chew, I think about it less. Dinner was congee, with preserved egg and scallions, which is one of the dishes I used to have Jane make you when you were sick. One of the dishes she made me when I was a child. It was one of my father's favorites as well, although he liked his with boiled chicken. I think Jane is dead. Matthew, too. No one has told me this, but I know, because they used to come visit me, and now they don't. Don't ask me how long ago, or how. I wouldn't be able to tell you. But they were old, older than your grandmother. I once overheard her telling you that her father had given her Jane and Matthew as a wedding present. Two servants from her father's household that would help her run her own. But that isn't true. Jane and Matthew were in the house well before your grandmother joined it. And besides, by that point, her father didn't have the money for a single servant, much less two he could give away. And if he had, it's unlikely he would have given them to her, when legally she wasn't even related to him by blood. I never knew what to do when I heard your grandmother tell you things that weren't true. I didn't want to contradict her. I knew better, and I wanted you to trust her and to love her. I wanted things to be easier for you than they were for me, and that meant having a good relationship with her. I worked hard to make that happen, and I think I succeeded, which means I didn't completely fail you. I made sure your grandmother loved you, but now you were grown and safe and living in New York, and I feel I can tell you the truth. I will say this for your grandmother. She took nothing she had for granted. What she had fought for and earned, and her life was dedicated to ensuring it never slipped away from her. She raised me to feel the opposite. And yet there were times I think she felt resentful that I did, even though it had been her intention. She never resented my father for it, and yet she resented me, because I was partially hers, and I should therefore be aware of how precarious my position was, because then her own anxiety would feel less lonely. We often end up resenting our children when they achieve what we've wished for them. Although this isn't my way of saying that I resent you, even though my only wish was that you grow up and leave me behind. About my father, I have little to say that you don't already know. I was already 8, almost 9 when he died, and yet I have few memories of him. He is a blurred, jovial presence, sporty and hearty, swinging me up in the air when he came home from work, dangling me upside down as I squealed, trying and failing to teach me how to hit a ball. I wasn't like him, but he didn't seem dissatisfied with me, the way I knew my mother to be, from almost the time I had a sense of her opinions at all. I liked reading, and he would call me Professor, never sarcastically, even though what I liked to read were just comic books. This is Vika, the reader in the family. He'd introduce me to acquaintances, and I would feel embarrassed, because I knew that I was reading nothing important, that I didn't really have the right to call myself a reader. But it hadn't mattered to him. If I had ridden horses, I would have been the rider. And if I had played tennis, I would have been the athlete. And it wouldn't have made a difference if I had distinguished myself or not. Most of the money had been spent by the time my father joined the family firm, and he didn't seem interested in replenishing its coffers. We'd spend weekends at the club, where we'd have lunch together, people stopping by our table to shake my father's hand and smile at my mother, the slice of coconut layer cake, soapy sweet and shagged like a carpet, that my father always ordered for me at the end, despite my mother's protestations, placed in front of me. Before my father joined his golf game, and my mother sat with her stack of magazines beneath an umbrella near the pool where she could watch me. Later, when Edward and I were becoming friends, I would stay quiet as he talked about going to the beach on the weekends with his mother. They would pack containers of food and spend all day there, his mother sitting on a blanket with her friends, Edward running into the water and then back out, in, and then out, until the sky began to darken and they packed their things to leave. The club was near the ocean. When you were on the course, you could see stripes of it through the trees, a band of glinting blue. But we would never have thought of going there. It was too sandy, too wild, too poor. But I never said this to Edward. I said I loved going to the beach as well, even though when we started going together, part of me was always thinking about when we could leave, when I could take a shower and become clean again. It wasn't until my father died that I realized we were rich. And by then, we were far less rich than we had been. But the kind of wealth my father had possessed wasn't of an obvious kind. Our house was large, but it was like everyone else's, with a wide porch and a large crowded sunroom and a small kitchen. I had all the toys I wanted, but my first bike was secondhand, a hand-me-down from a boy on the next street. We had Jane and Matthew, but our meals were simple, rice and meat of some kind for dinner, rice and fish and eggs for breakfast, a metal bento box I took to school for lunch. And it was only when my parents entertained, and the candles were lit, and the chandelier was cleaned, that the house looked grand, and that I was able to recognize that there was something stately in its simplicity. The dark, shining dining room table, the smooth white wood of the walls and ceiling, the vases of flowers that were replaced every other day. This was in the late 40s, when our neighbors were laying linoleum over their floors and replacing their dishware with plastic. But ours was not, as my mother said, a house of convenience. In our house, the floors were wood, and the cutlery was silver, and the plates and bowls were china. Not expensive china, but not plastic either. The post-war years had brought new wealth to the islands, new things from the mainland. But here again, our household did not indulge in what my mother considered trends. Why would you buy expensive oranges from Florida when the ones from our yard were even better? Why should you buy raisins from California when the lychee from our trees were even sweeter? They've gone mainland mad, she would say about our neighbors. She was dismissive of what she saw as their gullibility, in which she saw a kind of self-loathing for where we lived and who we were. Edward was never able to see that aspect of her fierce nationalism, her love for her home. He saw only the inconsistency with which that pride was expressed, the way she scorned other people for wanting the latest music and food from the mainland, while also wearing the pearls she had bought in New York, the long cotton skirts that she ordered from her dressmaker in San Francisco, where she and my father had made annual trips, a habit she continued after his death. Twice a year, the three of us would drive out to La'ie, on the North Shore. Here, there was a small coral rock church for which my great-grandfather had been the benefactor since he was a young man. And it was from here that my father would distribute envelopes of money, $20 for each adult, to celebrate my great-grandfather's birthday and then the day of his death, by giving a gift to the people of the town his grandfather had loved. As we approached the church, turning off the road onto a dirt path, we would see the townspeople clumped around the door, and as my father climbed out and advanced toward the building, they would bow. "Your Highness," they would murmur, these big, dark people, their voices unnaturally soft. "Welcome back, King." My father would nod at them, offer his hands to be taken and squeezed, and inside he would distribute the money and then would sit to listen to the best singer among them, who would sing a song, and then someone else who would chant, and then we would get into the car and drive back to town. These visits always made me uncomfortable. I felt, even as a young boy, as if I were a fraud. What had I done to be called prince? To have an old woman, so old that she spoke only Hawaiian, bow before me, her hand clenching the head of her cane so she wouldn't fall. On the ride home, my father was cheery, whistling the song that had just been performed for him. while my mother sat by his side, straight and silent and regal. After my father died, I had gone with her alone, and although the townspeople had been respectful, they had acknowledged only me, not her. And although she was always polite to them, she didn't have my father's good humor, or his ability to make people far poorer than he feel like his equal, and the occasion took on a strained quality. By the time I was 18, and expected to discharge this duty myself, the entire enterprise had begun to feel anachronistic and condescending, and from then on, my mother just sent an annual donation to the local community center for it to distribute in whatever way benefited its members. Not that I was capable of being my father anyway. That was what I had told her, that I wasn't a substitute for him. "You don't understand, Vika," she had said wearily. "You're not his substitute. You're his heir." But she hadn't contradicted me either. We both knew I couldn't equal my father. Things changed after he died, of course. For my mother, the changes were more profound and threatening. Once his debts had been paid, he had liked to gamble and had liked cars, there was less money left than she had assumed. She had also lost with him a sense of security in who she was. He had legitimized who she always claimed to be, and without him, she would forever be defending her right to call herself nobility. But the other change was that my mother and I were left with only each other, and it wasn't until my father had left us that we both realized that it was he who had provided us our identities. She was Kavika Bingham's wife. I was Kavika Bingham's son. Even now that he was gone, we still defined ourselves in relation to him. But without him, our relation to each other seemed more capricious. She was now Kavika Bingham's widow. I was Kavika Bingham's heir. But Kavika Bingham himself no longer existed. And without him, we no longer knew how to relate to each other. After my father's death, my mother became increasingly involved with her society, Kaika Mahini Ku Hawaii. The group, whose members referred to themselves as the Daughters, was open to anyone who could prove noble lineage. My mother's own claim to noble blood was a complicated subject. Her adopted father, who was a distant cousin of my father's, had been noble. He, like my father, could trace his family all the way back to before the great king. But my mother's origins were more opaque. As I grew older, I would hear various stories about who she was. The most common was that she was, in fact, her adopted father's illegitimate child, and that her mother had been a fling, a howly cocktail waitress who'd returned home to America soon after giving birth. But there were other theories as well, including that she was not only not noble, but not even of Hawaiian blood, that her mother had been her adoptive father's secretary, and that her father had been her adoptive father's manservant. Her father had been known to prefer hiring howlies because he liked to show off that he had the stature and money to have white people work for him. When she occasionally spoke about her adoptive father, she would say only that he was always kind to her, though from someone, who I don't know, I must have gotten the sense that, while he might have been kind to her, it was in a vague sort of way. He was strict with his own children, his daughter and his son, because he expected more from and for them. They had the power to disappoint him, but they also had the power to please him. They were embodiments of him in a way my mother was not. Marrying my father had quieted most of the rumors. His origins were inarguable, unimpeachable. But with his death, I believe she felt she was once again on the defensive, alert and attuned to any challengers. It was why she did so much work with the Daughters, why she hosted their annual fundraisers, why she led committees, why she chaired charity initiatives, why she tried in all the ways appropriate for her imagination and her era to be the ideal Hawaiian woman. The problem, though, with trying to be the ideal anything is that eventually the definition changes, and you realize that what you'd been pursuing all along was not a single truth, but a set of expectations determined by context. You leave that context, and you leave behind those expectations too, and then you're nothing once again. When Edward first met my mother, he was careful and polite. It wasn't until later, when we became close again as adults, that he became suspicious of her. She couldn't speak Hawaiian, he pointed out. Neither could I, aside from the few phrases and words we all knew, and a dozen songs and chants. I spoke only English and some French. She didn't support the struggle. She didn't support the return of the Hawaiian kingdom. But he never mentioned, as others had, how light-skinned she was. He was lighter still, and if you hadn't grown up on the islands, you wouldn't know to look past his hair and eyes to see his Hawaiianness, a secret hiding just beneath. By that point, he had grown envious of my own appearance, my own skin and hair and eyes. Sometimes I'd look up to catch him staring at me. "You should grow your hair out," he said to me once. "More authentic that way." It bothered him that even then, when everyone was wearing their hair long, I still wore mine as my father had worn his, tidy and very short, because it was woolly and dense, and if it got too long, it puffed out around my head. "I don't want it to look like an afro," I said, and he sat up from his usual slouch, leaning forward. "What's wrong with an afro?" he asked, giving me that unblinking stare he sometimes did when his eyes darkened, turned a deeper blue, and I began to stammer, as I did when I was nervous. "Nothing," I said. "Nothing's wrong with an afro." He leaned back and gazed at me for a long moment, and I had to look away. "A real Hawaiian wears his hair big," he said. His own hair was curly, but fine, like a child's, and he wore it tied back with an elastic band. "Big and proud." He began calling me accountant after that, because he said I looked like I should be working in a bank somewhere, counting other people's money. "How's it, accountant?" he'd say in greeting when he came to pick me up. "Business good?" It was a taunt, I knew, but at times it felt almost loving, a term of affection, something only we shared. I never knew what to say when he criticized my mother. By this time, it had long ago been made clear that I could never make her happy, and yet I couldn't help but feel protective of her, even though she'd never asked for my protection. And indeed, I had none to give her. I would like to think in retrospect that part of what made me uncomfortable was his implication that there was only one way to be Hawaiian. But I hadn't been sophisticated enough to think in those terms back then. The idea that my race compelled me to be one way or another at all was so foreign that it would have been like telling me that there was another, more correct way to breathe or swallow. I now know that all around me there were people my age who were having those very conversations: how to be black, or oriental, or American, or a woman. But I had never heard those conversations, and when I finally did, it was in Edward's company. So instead, I would just say, "She's Hawaiian," though even as I said it, I could hear it sounded like a question. "She's Hawaiian?" Which is maybe why Edward answered as he did. "No, she's not," he said. But let me go back to when we first met. I was 10 at the time, recently made fatherless. Edward was new that year. The school admitted new waves of students in kindergarten, 5th grade, 7th grade, and 9th grade. Later, Edward would curse the fact that we'd attended this school when we could have attended the school that only admitted students with Hawaiian blood. Our school had been granted by the King's Charter, but was founded by missionaries. "Of course we didn't learn about who we are and where we came from," he'd said. "Of course we didn't. That damn school's entire mission was to colonize us into submission. And yet he'd gone there as well. It was one of the many examples of things in my and Edward's shared life that he would come to hate or be ashamed of. And my refusal or inability to be equally ashamed, though I was ashamed of plenty of other things, came to infuriate him too. I attended the school because members of my family had always attended the school. On the high school part of the campus, there was even a building called Bingham Hall, one of the first structures the missionaries had built, named for one of the reverends who would later marry the crown princess. Every Kavika Bingham who had attended the school, my father and grandfather and great-grandfather and great-great-grandfather, posed for a photograph or drawing in front of the building, standing beneath the name which had been tapped into stone. No one from Edward's family had ever attended the school, and it was only, he told me, because of a scholarship that he was able to go at all. He told me these things matter-of-factly, without self-pity or embarrassment, which I found remarkable. We became friends slowly. Neither of us had any others. When I had been younger, there were some boys whose mothers wanted them to befriend me because of who my father was, who my mother was. It makes me cringe even now, the memory of one of them trudging across the playground toward me, introducing himself, asking if I wanted to play. I always said yes, and there'd be a lackluster game of catch. After a few days of this, I'd be invited to his house. Matthew would drive me if they didn't live in the valley. There, I'd meet the boy's mother, who would smile at me and serve us a snack. Vienna sausages and rice, or bread and passion fruit jam, or baked breadfruit with butter. There'd be another silent game of catch, and then Matthew would drive me home. Depending on how ambitious the boy's mother was, there might be another two or three invitations, but eventually they would stop. And at school, the boy would bolt toward his real friends at recess, never looking at me. They were never cruel to me. They never bullied me. But that was only because I wasn't worth bullying. In the neighborhood, as I told you, there were boys who bullied me, but I grew used to that as well. It was a kind of attention. I was friendless because I was boring. But Edward was friendless because he was strange. He didn't look strange. His clothes weren't as new as ours, but they were the same clothes, the same Hawaiian shirts and cotton pants. But he had, even then, a kind of inwardness. He was somehow able to suggest, without ever saying it, that he needed no one else, that he knew something that none of the rest of us did. And until we did, it wasn't worth his trying to have a conversation with us. It was early in the school year when he approached me one recess period. I was sitting, as I always did, at the base of the giant monkey pod tree, reading a comic book. The tree was at the top of the field, which sloped gently toward the southern end of campus, and as I read, I could watch my classmates, the boys playing soccer, the girls jumping rope. Then I looked up and saw Edward loping toward me. But something in his air made me think he was just walking my direction, not that I was his destination. Yet it was in front of me that he stopped. "You're Kavika Bingham," he said. "Vika," I said. "What?" he asked. "Vika," I said. "People call me Vika." "Okay," he said. "Vika." And then he walked off. For a moment, I felt uncertain. Was I Kavika Bingham? And then I realized I was, because he had confirmed it. The next day he returned. "My mother wants you to come over after school tomorrow," he said. He had a way of speaking in which he looked not at you, but at a point beyond you, which meant that when he finally did turn his gaze directly to you, as he did now, waiting for my answer, it felt particularly intense, almost interrogatory. "Okay," I said. I didn't know what else to say. The following morning, I told Matthew and Jane that I was going to a classmate's house after school. I told them quickly, quietly, as I ate my breakfast, for I knew somehow that my mother would not approve of Edward. This may have been unfair. My mother was not dismissive of people with less money than she had, at least not in a way I would have recognized at the time. But I knew I couldn't tell her. Matthew and Jane looked at each other. All of my other playdates had been arranged by the boys' mothers with my mother. I had never arranged one on my own. I could tell they were happy for me, and trying not to make me self-conscious. "You need me to come get you afterward, Vika?" asked Matthew. But I shook my head. I already knew that Edward lived near the school, which meant I'd be able to walk home as usual. Jane got up. "You'll want to bring something to give his mother," she said, and went to the pantry for one of her jars of mango jam. "Tell her she can send back the jar with you when she's done, and I'll refill it next season. All right, Vika?" That seemed very optimistic. Mango season had just ended, so in order to get a refilled jar, Mrs. Bishop would have to count on her son and me remaining friends for another year. But I only said thank you, and put the jar in my backpack. Edward and I were in adjoining classrooms, and he waited for me at the building's exit. We walked in silence through the middle school campus, and then hopped over the low wall that encircled the school. He lived just a block south of this wall, in the middle of a pokey street I'd often driven down with Matthew. My first thought was that the house was charmed. The street was lined with small, single-story shops and businesses, a dry goods shop, a hardware store, a grocer, and then suddenly, as if conjured, was a tiny wooden house. The rest of the block was denuded of greenery, but looming over the structure was a large mango tree, so domineering and leafy that it seemed to be protecting the little building from sight. Nothing else grew in the lawn, not even grass, and the concrete path leading to the front porch had buckled from the tree's roots, one of which had split a paving stone in two. The house itself was a miniature version of the kind you saw in my neighborhood, a plantation house, as I learned to call them, with a wide lanai and large windows shaded by metal awnings. The next surprise was the door itself, which was actually closed. Everyone I knew kept their doors open until they went to bed. There was only the screen door, which you banged through as you entered and exited. I watched as Edward reached down the front of his shirt and drew out a key, which dangled from a cotton string that hung around his neck, and unlocked the door. He slipped off his Zoris and walked in, and I waited, stupidly, for an invitation before I realized I was to follow him. Inside, it was close and dark, and after relocking the door, Edward went around the living room, cranking open the jalousies to let in the breeze, though the mango tree blocked all the light. But its shade also kept the house cool and heightened its sense of bewitchment. "Do you want a snack?" Edward asked, already walking to the kitchen. "Yes, please," I said. He returned to the living room a few moments later with two plates, one of which he gave to me. On it were arranged four soda crackers, each with a daub of mayonnaise. He sat down on one of the rattan couches, and I sat on the other, and we ate our snack in silence. I had never had mayonnaise on crackers before, and wasn't sure I liked it, or even if I was supposed to like it. Edward ate his crackers quickly, as if it were a chore to be dispensed with, and then stood again. "Do you want to see my room?" he asked, and again he asked almost sideways, as if he were addressing someone else in the room, although there was only me. "Yes," I said. There were three closed doors to the left of the living room. He opened the one on the right, and we entered a bedroom. This room, too, was small, but it was also cozy, like the lair of a harmless animal. There was a narrow bed with a striped blanket on it, and strung across the ceiling from one corner to the opposite were chains of bright-colored construction paper. "My mother and I made those," Edward explained, and although later I would remember how remarkable his tone was, so matter-of-fact, almost proud, when we were coming to an age in which announcing you made crafts, much less with your mother, was inadvisable. What I thought then was how foreign the idea was of making anything with your mother, especially something that you would hang from your ceiling, deliberately transforming your room into some place messier and stranger than it had to be. Now Edward turned and retrieved an object from the drawer beneath the table next to his bed. "Look at this," he said, solemnly, and held out a black velvet box about the size of a deck of playing cards. He opened the hinged lid, and inside was a medal made of coppery metal. It was the seal of our school, and, on a scroll beneath, the words "Scholarship, 1953 to 1954. He flipped it over to show me his name engraved on the back, Edward Paella Bishop. "What's it for?" I asked, and he made a small, impatient sound. "It's not for anything," he said. "They gave it to me when I got my scholarship." "Oh," I said. I realized I was supposed to say something, but couldn't decide what it might be. I didn't know anyone else who was on a scholarship. In fact, until I had met Edward, I didn't even know what a scholarship was, and had had to ask Jane for an explanation. "It's nice," I said, and he made the sound again. "It's stupid," he said. But when he replaced the box in its drawer, he did so tenderly, smoothing his hand across its furred surface. Then he reached into another drawer, this one tucked beneath his bed. Over time, I would realize that, although the room was minute, it was as well organized and efficient as a sailor's berth, and that whoever had arranged it had accounted for all of Edward's interests, all of his needs, and retrieved a cardboard box. "Checkers," he said. "Want to play?" As we played game after game of checkers, mostly in silence, I had time to consider what was most unusual about Edward's house. It was not its size or its darkness, though curiously, the dim made it not gloomy but snug, and even as the afternoon stretched on, there was no need to turn on a lamp, but the fact that we were there all alone. In my house, I was never alone. If my mother was at one of her meetings, there was Jane and sometimes Matthew. But Jane was always there. She was cooking in the kitchen, or she was dusting in the living room, or she was sweeping the upstairs hallway. The farthest she strayed was to the side of the house, to hang the laundry on the line, or occasionally to the driveway, to bring Matthew, who was washing the car, his lunch. Even that night, she and Matthew were only a few hundred feet away, in their apartment above the garage. But I had never before been to a classmate's house where there was no mother. You didn't expect to see a father. They were creatures who materialized only at dinner time, never in the afternoon. But the mothers were always there, a presence as reliable as a couch or a table. Sitting there, on Edward's bed, playing checkers, I had the sudden notion that he lived by himself. I had a vision of Edward making himself dinner on the stove. I was not allowed to touch the stove in my house, heating it at the kitchen table, washing the dishes, taking a bath, and putting himself to bed. There had been plenty of times when I had resented the lack of any true, meaningful privacy in my house, but suddenly the alternative, an absence of people, nothing but time and silence, seemed horrible. And it seemed to me that I should stay with Edward as long as I could, for when I left, he would have no one. But as I was thinking this, there was a sound of the door opening, and then a woman's voice, bright and cheerful, calling Edward's name. "My mother," Edward said, and for the first time, he smiled, a quick, bright grin, and climbed off the bed and hurried into the living room. I followed, to see Edward's mother kissing him, and then, before he could say anything, approaching me with her arms held out. "You must be Vika," she said, smiling. "Edward's told me so much about you," and she pulled me close. "It's nice to meet you, Mrs. Bishop," I remembered to say, and she beamed and squeezed me again. Victoria, she corrected me. And then, seeing my face, or Auntie, just not Mrs. Bishop. She turned to Edward, her arms still wrapped around me. Are you boys hungry? No, we had a snack, he said, and she smiled at him too. Good boy, she said, and yet her praise seemed to include me as well. I watched her as she went to the kitchen. She was the most beautiful mother I had ever seen. So beautiful that if I had encountered her in another context, I would never have associated her with motherhood at all. She had dark blonde hair, twisted into a bun at the base of her head, and her skin was a dark gold as well, more light-filled than mine, but darker than her son's, and she wore what was in those days considered a low-cut dress of pink cotton with white bands at the sleeves and throat, and a full skirt that spun around her legs as she moved. She smelled delicious, like a combination of fried meat, and beneath that, the gardenia blossom she wore pinned behind her ear. And she didn't walk, but twirled through the little house as if it were a palace, someplace expansive and dazzling. It was only when she said that she hoped I was staying for dinner that I looked at the round-faced clock above the sink and realized that it was almost 5:30, and I had told Matthew and Jane I'd be home an hour ago. Never would I have assumed I would have wanted to stay at another boy's house for so long. I could feel myself entering that stage of distress I often did when I knew I had done something wrong, but Mrs. Bishop told me not to worry, just to call home, and when Jane picked up, she sounded relieved. Matthew will come get you now, she said, before I even had a chance to ask if I could stay for dinner, which I wasn't sure I wanted to do anyway. He'll be there in 10 minutes. I have to go home, I told Mrs. Bishop when I had hung up. I'm sorry. And she smiled at me again. You'll stay next time, she said. She spoke in a slight sing-song. We'd like that, right, Edward? And Edward nodded, though he was already moving about the kitchen with his mother, removing things from the refrigerator, and seemed to have forgotten I was still there. Before I left, I gave her the jar of mango jam in my bag. This is for you, I said. I knew not to clarify that she was the housekeeper and not my mother, said you could give it back to me when it's empty, and then she'll refill it next season. But then I remembered the tree outside and felt foolish, and was about to apologize when Mrs. Bishop pulled me close again. My favorite, she said. Tell your mother thank you, she laughed. I may need to ask her for the recipe. Every year I swear I'm going to make jam, and every year I never do. I'm such a klutz in the kitchen, you see. And she actually winked at me, as if she were letting me know a secret that no one else was privy to, not even her son. I heard Matthew's car pull up outside and said goodbye to them both. But on the lanai, I turned and looked through the screen door and saw the two of them, mother and son, in the kitchen making dinner. Edward said something to his mother, and she tipped her head back and laughed, and then reached over and rubbed the top of his head playfully. They had turned the kitchen light on, and I had the strange sense that I was looking inside a diorama, at a scene of happiness I could witness but never enter. Bishop, said my mother later that night. Bishop. I knew even then what she was thinking. Bishop was a famous name, an old name, almost as famous and old as our own. She was thinking that Edward was someone like us, and yet I knew he wasn't, not in the way she meant. What does his father do? She asked, and as I admitted I didn't know, I realized that I hadn't thought about his father at all. Part of this was, as I have said, because fathers were shadowy presences in all of our lives. You saw them on weekends and in the evenings, and if you were lucky, they were benevolent, distant beings with an odd piece of candy for you. And if you were unlucky, they were chilly and remote, dispensers of whippings and spankings. My understanding of the world was very limited, but even I somehow comprehended that Edward didn't have a father, or, more accurately, that Mrs. Bishop didn't have a husband. The two of them, mother and son, were so complete together, cooking in that miniature kitchen, she playfully butting her hip against his side, he dramatically skidding to the right, his mother laughing at him, that there was no room for a father or a husband. They were a matched set, one female, one male, and another man would simply disrupt their symmetry. "Well," my mother said, "we should have them over for tea." And so, the following Sunday, they came. They couldn't come on Saturday, I heard Jane tell my mother, because Mrs. Bishop had to work her shift. "Her shift," my mother echoed, in a tone that conveyed some meaning I couldn't quite interpret. "All right, Jane, tell her Sunday." They arrived on foot, yet weren't hot or flushed, which meant they had taken the bus and had walked to our house from the closest stop. Edward was wearing his school clothes. His mother was wearing another full-skirted cotton dress, this one hibiscus yellow, her dark blonde hair in its knot, her lips painted a cheery red, even more beautiful than I'd remembered. She was smiling as my mother approached her. "Mrs. Bishop, such a pleasure to meet you," she said, to which Mrs. Bishop responded, as she had to me, "Please, call me Victoria." "Victoria," my mother repeated, as if it were a foreign name and she wanted to make sure she was pronouncing it correctly. But she did not reciprocate the offer, though Mrs. Bishop seemed not to expect it. "Thank you so much for having us over," she said. "Edward," she turned her beam to her son, who was looking at my mother with a steady, serious expression, not quite suspicious, but alert, "is new this year, and Vika has been so kind to him." And now she turned to look at me, with that little wink, as if I had done her son a favor by talking to him, as if I had departed from my busy schedule in order to do so. Even my mother seemed slightly taken aback by this. "Well, I'm very glad to hear Vika has a new friend," she said. "Won't you come in?" We filed into the sunroom, where Jane served us shortbread, pouring the women coffee. "Oh, thank you, Jane. Thank you, Jane. This looks delicious." And Edward and me guava juice. I had seen other acquaintances of my mother grow silent and awestruck in this room, which to me was simply a room, sunlit and dull, but to them was a museum of my father's ancestors. The scarred wooden surfboard my great-grandfather, known as the Portly Prince, had ridden in Waikiki, the daguerreotypes of my great-great-grandfather's sister, the Queen, in her black taffeta gown, and a great-great-cousin, an explorer, who had a building at a famous university named for him. But Mrs. Bishop seemed unintimidated, and looked about herself openly, with genuine delight. "What a lovely room this is, Mrs. Bingham," she said, smiling at my mother. "My entire family has always been great admirers of your husband's family, and how much he did for the islands." It was exactly the right thing to say, done simply and well, and I could tell my mother was surprised. "Thank you," she said, a bit stiffly. "He loved his home." For a while, my mother talked to Edward, asking him if he liked his new school, yes, and if he missed his old friends, not really, and what his hobbies were, swimming, hiking, camping, going to the beach. When I became the parent of a young boy myself, I was able to appreciate Edward's composure, his apparent unflappability. As a child, I was eager, too eager to please, smiling desperately through conversations with my parents' friends, hoping I wouldn't shame them. But Edward was neither ingratiating nor awkward. He answered my mother's questions straightforwardly, without any pandering or apology. Even then, he possessed an unusual dignity, one that made him seem invincible. It was almost as if he didn't care about anyone else. And yet that would suggest that he was aloof or proud, and he wasn't either of those things. Finally, my mother was able to ask about Mr. Bishop. Certain members of the Bishop family had been distant cousins of my father, the way that all the old missionary families who had married into Hawaiian royalty were distant cousins. Was it possible that there might be a connection? Mrs. Bishop laughed. There was no bitterness in that laugh, no falsity. It was a sound of pure merriment. "Oh, I'm afraid not," she said. "I'm the only Hawaiian, not my husband." My mother looked blank, and Mrs. Bishop smiled again. It was quite a shock for Luke, a Howley boy from a small town in Texas whose father was a construction worker, to understand that here, his last name made him something special.
"I see," said my mother, quietly.
"So is your husband in construction as well?"
"He could be."
Again, the smile.
"But we just don't know, do we, Edward?"
Then to my mother.
"He left long ago, when Edward was a baby. I haven't seen him since."
I can't say, of course, that men didn't leave their families all the time in the early 50s. But I can say, and this was true even decades later, that to have your husband or father leave was something shameful, as if the responsible party was the abandoned, the wife and children. If people spoke about it, they did so in whispers. But not the bishops. Mr. Bishop had left, but they weren't the losers. He was. It was one of those rare moments in which my mother and I were united in our discomfiture. Before the bishops left, we learned that Sunday was Mrs. Bishop's day off. The other 6 days, she worked as a waitress at a busy diner a few blocks from their house called Mizumoto's, which my mother hadn't heard of, but Jane and Matthew had, and that she was from Honoka'a, a tiny town, a village, really, on the Big Island.
"What an extraordinary woman," my mother said,
watching as mother and son turned right at the end of our driveway and walked out of sight toward the bus stop. I could tell she didn't quite mean it as a compliment. I agreed with her. She was extraordinary. They both were. I had never encountered two people who seemed less abashed by the circumstances of their lives. But whereas that lack of apology manifested itself in Mrs. Bishop as an irrepressible buoyancy, the kind of cheer that exists only in the rare people who have never felt embarrassed for who they are, they were realized in Edward as a defiance, one that in later years curdled into anger. "I see this now, of course, but it took me a long time. And by that point, I had already given up my life, and therefore your life, for his, not because I shared his anger, but because I craved his certainty, this strange and wondrous notion that there really was a single answer, and that by believing in it, I would cease to believe everything that had bothered me about myself for so long. And now, Kavika, I will skip forward a number of years. First, though, I want to tell you about something that happened to me yesterday. I was lying in bed as usual. It was the afternoon, and hot. Earlier in the day, they had opened the windows and turned on the fan. But now the breeze had died, and no one had returned to switch on the air conditioning. This occasionally happened, and then someone would enter the room, exclaiming at how hot it was, scolding me a bit, as if I had the ability to call out for them and had simply refused to do so out of stubbornness. Once, they had forgotten to turn on the air conditioning at all, and my mother had made a surprise visit. I had heard her voice and her feet marching in, and then I heard her march back out again and return a few seconds later with an orderly who was apologizing again and again as my mother rebuked him. "Do you know how much I pay for my son to be looked after? Get me the manager on duty. This is unacceptable." I was humiliated hearing this, being so old and still in my mother's care, but also comforted
and I fell asleep to the sound of her anger. Normally, the heat didn't bother me so much, but yesterday, it was oppressive, and I could feel my face and hair becoming damp. I could feel sweat trickling into my diaper. Why won't someone come help me? I thought. I tried to make a sound, but I, of course, couldn't. And then something very strange happened. I stood. I cannot explain how this happened. I have not stood for years. Not since I was rescued from Lipo Vaunaheli. But now I was not only standing, I was trying to walk. Trying to move toward where I knew the air conditioning unit was. As I realized this, however, I fell. And after a few minutes, someone came into the room and started making a fuss, asking me why I was on the floor and if I'd rolled out of bed. For a minute, I worried she might strap me down, as has happened before, but she didn't, just buzzed for help. And then another person came in, and they returned me to bed, and then, thank goodness, switched on the air conditioner. The point, though, is that I had stood. I had been standing. It felt both foreign and also familiar to be upright again, even if I trembled for a long time afterward because my limbs were so wasted. Last night, after I had been fed and washed and the space was dark and silent, I began to think. It had been luck that no one had seen me standing, because if they had, there would have been questions, and my mother would have been called, and there would have been tests. The sorts I had had when I first came here. Why would I not walk? Why would I not speak? Why would I not see? You're asking the wrong questions, my mother had snapped to someone, a doctor. You should be asking why he can't do those things. No, Mrs. Bingham, the doctor replied, and I could hear an edge in his voice. I am asking exactly the right questions. It's not that your son can't do these things. It's that he won't. And my mother had been silent. Now, however, I realized, what if I could learn how to walk again? What if every day I practiced standing? What would happen? The thought scared me, but it was exciting as well. What if I was getting better after all? But I meant to continue my story. Throughout the remainder of fifth grade, Edward and I saw a lot of each other. Occasionally, he came to my house, but more often, I went to his, where we would play checkers or cards. When he came to my house, he'd want to play outside, as his yard was too small to toss a ball in. But he soon realized I wasn't much of an athlete. The strange thing, though, was that we never seemed to grow closer in any meaningful way. Boys that age may not exchange intimacies or secrets, but they do become more physical with each other. I remember you at that age, how you would tussle on the grass with your friends like little animals, how much of the fun you had with them was getting dirty together. But Edward and I weren't like that. I was too fastidious, and he was too composed. I sensed early on that he would never be someone I could relax around. And I didn't mind that. Then came summer. Edward went to the Big Island to stay with his grandparents. My mother and I went to Hana, where we at the time had a house that had been in my father's family since before annexation. And by the time school had resumed, something had shifted. Friendships at that age are so fragile.